Cloudy on the top.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Andy.
And this is Backjack's The Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast.
Welcome.
We're watching episode 5, that's Jack in Space.
And he's in space for about half of it?
Actually, probably a little bit less.
Something like maybe a third. It's after the commercial break. So, they take off right after the commercial break. So, I guess you'd say about half.
Okay.
The first half is set up, and then the second half is in space.
That's true. He's in the space shuttle for some of that part. So, yeah.
Actually, it looks like a Russian heavy lift vehicle when you see it. Well, we'll get there. Anyhow, we need one of those sweet, sweet episode descriptions that you do so well.
Well, here we are. Jack meets a group of brilliant astronaut scientists on the road north. Is this the fateful meeting the Wooly was foretelling, or is something else in store?
I don't know. I think the Woolies were probably foreseeing at least this. It was the most probable outcome if he went north. I think that's probably what they were talking about. Like, if you go north, you will find those who can help you. And he did. He found people who could. And if he had just stuck to the plan...
Yep.
He'd be back in the future, but we'll get there.
Back in the past.
So he's walking, and there's this beautiful scenery that he's in. It looks to me as if he is in some sort of northeastern rainforest. So he's in, like, Seattle area. There's mountains, there's an undespoiled ocean, there's lots of pine trees.
Well, actually, one of the things I noticed about this scene where we see him walking through that forest, the way they did the trees sliding on multiple layers and the trees in the background sliding on multiple layers.
It's kind of an anime.
The forest scene we see here harkens back to old Disney glass slide forest animations like we saw in Bambi.
Yeah, that's when they first kind of pioneered it.
Yeah, and when I saw that, I immediately remembered... Oh, right. This reminds me exactly of the establishing shots from Bambi.
And especially since they're doing this all, remember, this is all analog. They did not have hardly any computer animation available in this at all. I'm sure they still had some. We do see some shots that have to be computer animated.
Or at the very least are enhanced.
Or enhanced by, I think what they probably did was they just made like a wireframe. And they said, give us all of the keyframes, and we rotoscoped the wireframes and painted over them, which gave them that nice, smooth movement through, you know, like, oh, we're going to animate a full 24 frames of movement here to make it as smooth and cool as possible just right here. But as an animation budget, they didn't do that a lot. In the 90s and early 2000s, computers weren't quite as powerful to be able to do that under budget. It's been, I mean, they could. We saw Pixar doing stuff, but it was just like the rendering would take too long, even for a 2D animation. But it's beautiful. I mean, they really evoke this sense of like lonely Bigfoot wilderness. It's pretty awesome. And again, Backjack, no backpack. There he goes. Man and his sword.
Yep. And that's all he needs, apparently. But yeah, we see this sort of, old school glass slide forest animation lead into another hint that they're sort of hearkening back to Bambi. Because we see as he comes to the turn in the river just after that little waterfall,
see
a doe, and the doe drinks next to Jack, and there's sort of a comparison being made, sort of metaphor being suggested by the artist, and then a loud explosion. Both Jack and the doe look at the explosion, and they both run away in a very similar way. And it's sort of saying, like, at this point...
Jack is running towards it. The deer is running away from it.
Right.
But they both... I mean, the deer had no fear. The deer did not know humans. Did not go, predator, and run. Like, it came up to him like, well, that's a weird animal. Like, what's he... And Jack very politely scoots over. Like, yeah. Oh, would you like to drink as well? Here.
I couldn't help but feel like... Having these forest animations that really look a lot like the establishing shots in Bambi, and then having a doe appear in the same scene is sort of like saying...
It's a bit of a callback, yeah.
Yep, a little callback to those really intense, quite difficult animations from old school.
No, that's what Disney was doing in the day. It was like pushing it forward. This is what animation can be when you give it enough money. Like... There's been a couple of times in history where they've had some sort of technological or creative project where it's been like somebody along the way sees the potential. Somebody along the way says, wait a minute, we can do this if we just throw enough money at it. And this is what it'll look like. They did the same thing with the Xerox PARC machine that Steve Jobs just stole and turned into the Macintosh. And they had everything. They had menu. They had a desktop. They had a menuing system. They had a mouse. They had – the only thing that was different is they turned the screen upright. So instead of widescreen, it was a tall screen, which was fine because it looked like a document, and that was their paradigm.
Okay.
But, I mean, when they built that machine, it was – at least 10 to 15 years ahead of its time, because they built it in the mid-70s. And it's like, well, what would a computer with 128K and, you know, an 8088 processor, which were brand new and only used in supercomputers, like, what would that look like? So they spent a bunch of money, and they built this computer that looked thoroughly modern from our standpoint in the late 80s, early 90s, and said, well, here's what it would. Yeah, but this computer cost $20,000 to build. Same thing. They're like, Disney went, well, yeah, you can do frame by frame animation, and you can do sweatshop animation and little 5-minute shorts, because that's all these guys can do. Or we can throw millions of dollars at a gigantic animation department and do, you know, only have keyframes when we really need it for in-betweening, and the rest is fluid.
Yeah. And when you see
people have never seen that on
the
screen.
The photos that they took of those animation studios for Disney, for Bambi specifically.
Yeah.
It was a massive project. Just to get that one establishing shot was a massive project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to make all these different series of forests, and you have to take photos of them, just fractions of millimeters movement between the frames. And you're just moving that slide ever so slightly to the right, ever so slightly to the right.
Mm-hmm.
It was painstaking, but, you know, Disney wasn't afraid to make his workers do it anyway.
And make sure they had lots of drugs. So we see this, though, and it's kind of like it's established now. Like, it's in animation everywhere now, because once you can, like, do that, you can just print out cells to do it. And even in modern, you know, up through the 80s, they did – Filmation did that for other, like, He-Man and G.I. Joe and a few others. It slide the cells around to indicate movement. And Gendy uses it to a tremendous effect in Samurai Jack by just having him, you know, a little outline shape and then moving the backgrounds a little. So it looks like the camera's panning as it's following him. Mm-hmm. It just gives that impression.
Right. Instead of having to draw or paint it all out on a glass slide and horribly slide it over and take photographs of it frame by frame. Yeah. Yikes.
That's horrible.
Yeah. I'm glad I didn't live back then.
But, I mean, it sees him, you know, he's kind of back in his element again. He's in the forest. It's beautiful. There's a deer. There's a waterfall. He's getting a drink of cool water to refresh himself. And then, you know, as usual, all hell breaks loose and things start exploding.
Yep.
And the deer runs away smartly. And Jack runs towards it. And the more explosions he hears, and he's in that cool superhero lean forward with lines in the background.
Yep.
And his face, and the more explosions he hears, the more determined he looks.
Yeah, Naruto run, eat your heart out. It's the Samurai Jack run.
Yeah. He's like, oh, there's explosions. Something bad is going down. I must help. Like, immediately. He could have just ignored them and kept walking. Again, the quest givers are there. He could have walked away. No. They told me to walk north. This must have something to do with what the Wooly told me.
For those of you who've seen Season 5, yes, we will talk about that later.
Cool. So he finds this awesome little rocket camp. It looks like how the 1960s viewed the future. It's a very 2001 A Space Odyssey look.
Yeah,
to, you know, see spheres and tubes and
a variety of interestingly shaped, vaguely human-looking astronaut scientists. And you get the impression that we see a wide variety of them, and they all seem to be, if anything, Gendy or the rest of the animation crew's impressions of the scientists who you always see in the recordings, you know, watching a successful shuttle landing or watching their probe land.
Before that, even, that goes back to, like, old NASA moonshots. Like, the way they looked, the way the suits looked, this groovy vision, this way that they did bowling alleys. You'll see it, you know, the Starlight Drive. They picked up some of that style for Fallout, the game Fallout, for example. It's this sort of very specific 60s groovy style. And that's how they're all drawn. They're all are drawn to look like the image of somebody you kind of recognize. So they sort of look like one of those scientists. They sort of look like one of those old astronauts. You can't quite place it. And there's even a woman there with a pink helmet.
Oh, yeah.
And who just
so has, you know.
Just so you know, there are women there, too. There are women scientists. And suddenly they're under attack by gigantic praying mantises.
Praying mantises, which I would like to point out, have an extra pair of legs. Praying mantises usually only have two sets of legs on which they stand, and the pair of legs that they have as their pinchers, you know?
And they have the scythe hands. They all have the scythe hands, and this seems to be like a design thing for Aku. Like, he patterns all of these things. He sends a bug army to wipe out his foes, and they all have these things. At least these are armed with, like, lasers and missiles. So they have some distance attack capacity, which they don't use to stand back and blow up the camp. They immediately charge in and do what I thought they were going to do. Like, this is cool. My theory proves true that these are weapons of terror. They're really tall, and as weapons platforms, they're not that great. But those scythe hands are just ripping apart everything that they built there, everything they set up. And what are the astronaut people doing? Running like crazy as things are getting blown up all around them.
They scatter.
And this is exactly what they're supposed to do. You see, it's been an effective tactic for Aku. No wonder he keeps making them. It has this effect on people. So he sees this happening, and he has that Jack look on his face where he makes the decision. And then he jumps into combat. And he's just gotten done beating hundreds and hundreds of smaller beetle-sized ones. So these, short work. Boom, boom, boom.
Kill. Although, when we see them, like, arm up, we see that classic Genndy Tartakovsky overkill missile array where they...
and they pop out of nowhere.
They transform a bunch of missiles appearing, growing out of them. Very reminiscent to his work in Dexter's Lab, if any of you remember that. The missiles coming out of the sides of things, necks and arms, their chests, just 1,000, you know, guns and missiles coming out. This was the exact same thing. The praying mantises had guns in their sickle arms and...
Yeah, the sickle flipped down and there's a gun under it. Like, yo, dog, I heard you like guns.
And they had missiles coming out of every orifice. I mean, really...
I did not see any ass missiles.
Okay, but it was a classic Dexter's Lab scene. He definitely took some inspiration on that moment from his earlier work.
I agree. And they all point at Jack. Yep. Oh, who's this interloper? And this is another cool thing. Like, it cuts to a POV shot. It cuts to a point of view shot for the bugs where you see through their, like, red scanner. And their eyes don't seem to be...
Compound.
Yeah, like the other ones are. I mean, they look compound. They're not. And they're scanning and scanning and scanning. And you can actually, we've actually paused it, to see, like, what they were saying. And it says what you'd expect, you know, unauthorized construction, destroy. And
some of it was gibberish.
Terminator vision, you know.
Some of it was English. And they were using a font that I don't think either of us have ever seen anywhere else.
No, it was brilliant. Cause on a brief flash on a TV screen, an odd amount of people might have caught unauthorized, or they might have caught scanning, but only briefly. It was only on the screen for like 2 seconds. And if you stop it and look at it, some of it clearly is just gibberish. I think they hand drew it. I'm not sure that's actually even a real font.
Yeah, it could be.
Because if it was, I mean, I totally would use that. So it scans everything. These are all unauthorized. Unauthorized escape attempt. So here we see them saying something to the effect of,
"You have been found guilty of breaking Aku Law 101 and 203, habitation in an unauthorized facility, and unauthorized construction of an escape vehicle. Your punishment is extermination."
And this indicates to me that Aku actually does have a law, you know, 121, whatever. This is like Aku actually did have a numbered series of laws, and they were all very harsh. But his evil is law, and that's what they were enforcing. Even in the farthest reaches of, you know, the back end of nowhere in the mountains and the forests, he was able to send a bug army to try to kill them in a very short period of time, which leads me to believe that they're not terribly far from the city and they're not terribly far from where Jack was the first time. So it could be that Aku was just keeping an eye on him. Once Aku saw where Jack was going, he might have said, "Oh, that's where they went. The Wooly told him to go that way. I wonder what's north. Oh, look, Aku, again, very obvious." He doesn't go out of his way to look for things, but if it's right in front of him and he can track Jack, which apparently he can anytime he feels like it, because Aku watches you, then he would have drawn a straight line and gone, "Oh, that's where those astronauts went that escaped me," and sent them in. It could be that they tried to make an escape when Aku was preoccupied with Jack. "No, he's just sent out all the robots. Now's our chance to escape." "But that's a huge risk. We weren't quite ready yet." "No, the ship is prepared. We must go." That would be, I would imagine, a fanfic conversation that these scientists had. They took their shot. because as powerful as he is, Aku can still only pay attention to one thing at a time. So when they finally get there, they read them the riot act and then start ripping their shit apart with their scythe hands and blowing things up. And Jack leaps into action and slices them to pieces, except his final attack, because remember, he's still viewing these things as organic for some reason instead of robots. He cuts the head off, which would ordinarily be a nice beheading maneuver, except the head takes off. Instead of a warhead, it's a warning head. And apparently it's designed that if the last of them gets attacked, it takes off into the air to warn Aku or to warn others nearby or to get a clear signal out. Hey, they just defeated all of us. And by the way, there's the samurai here cutting us to pieces. You need to send more troops. And now we get a kind of a look at scientists, a good look at them, because the scene will like freeze on them. And again, we see that they're all in these environment suits. Right? They're all in these sort of weird ovaloid, and that like the domes on them match their heads.
Yep.
So the woman's a sort of roundish, and the crazy German guy has the sort of a squarish one. This is where they start laying the plot on him. And the plot is, how are we ever going to get away? Now he knows where he is. We're doomed.
Well, they also say a few other things. You know, they explain that they were scientists working on Earth to build Aku's army. They explain that they were the ones that made the insect drones. And we see those pretty much as the representation of Aku in this episode. So we see them as mantis drones. We'll see them later in space.
Space bugs.
And obviously saw them throughout that dog episode, you know. Mm-hmm. So They made a large amount, or at least they designed them.
You'd think that, like most hackers, they would build in a back door somehow. That they would have put a failsafe kill code in there so they couldn't kill them.
Maybe they were afraid Aku could, you know, sense their treacherous thoughts or something like that. I mean, all he has to do is say, show me the fool, and open his little fire vagina and see.
Yeah, that's true. I think they may betray me. Show me who would betray Aku.
Yeah, exactly.
Voop, and it would show exactly which scientists were working on whatever backdoor built into the software.
Jack doesn't have to worry about that as much because he's literally carrying the one thing that would destroy Aku. If Aku says, well, show me Jack planning to destroy me, he just sees Jack, like, come and do something, you know? Like, go ahead.
It's too vague.
Right.
But if he asks and uses his power to give him a specific, if the magic is shaped specifically to Aku's will, but Aku's will isn't specific enough because he doesn't know, then he can't. So he has to wait for Jack to attack somewhere. It's tough for him to anticipate what he's going to do until he gets there. Well, like he can draw lines and go, oh, well, he's here, but that's all the farther he can see. I think one of the things that they might have built into it also is that these things had horrible tracking. They weren't hitting anything.
Right.
They were expending a lot of ammo as the people were running around going, oh, help, and running around in circles. And they were just going, boom, 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 and launching missiles everywhere. For as cool of a robo heads-up display as they had, that might have been their backdoor. That it's harder to hit us in our encounter suits, in our spacesuit things we're wearing. Like, maybe it couldn't get a lock on them, and that's why it didn't just slaughter them.
Well, it could be that they deliberately made them poor at aiming, but really impressive to see from a demonstration standpoint. You know, if you're demonstrating its power and you show it, just like people like to show, you know, a new type of gun that they've just designed, and they show it by having it blow up a TV, you know, or something like that.
Watermelon or something.
You don't have to be particularly accurate. You can blow it to pieces and that's very impressive. But in reality, like, you missed with 30% of the ammo and that's a big waste, you know.
I mean, at least a laser should have been accurate, but
We see it's possible that they did make it, you know, impressive for demonstrations, not so good in actual combat. But what we really are getting at is it possible they don't want to destroy the astronaut scientists because they are valuable scientists? We don't see too many of them.
So maybe bring them back then.
Yeah, like, you know, destroy the things they've created that represent a breach of the law. And then bring them back, because we found out that creating these pods, it even says out loud, creating an illegal escape pod, creating illegal rocket technology. If it isn't licensed, you can't make something that can get off of Aku, or I guess that's what he's named, Earth. You can't leave this planet. Now, unless you're approved with a license to even make technology that can escape the atmosphere.
He doesn't want people leaving.
Right.
That's the one thing, the technology that can do over supernatural stuff. Science works, whether you believe it or not, whether you have the will to make it work or not, whether you're evil or not, technology just works.
So what
do
we see? No matter
who does it, it's a tool.
The robots are mostly destroying those things so that people don't escape, you know?
True.
So maybe they aren't really aiming for the people as much as keeping them away while they finish destroying the...
That could be a thought, too, because if they just want to destroy the stuff, it didn't say capture. If it had said something like return assets to Aku's laboratories or something, right, that would have been a lot clearer spelt out. But even at one point, they say something like, we don't want to surrender. And it's like, well, actually, we have better chance of surviving if we surrender, which... No, they really don't. He's going to send them to the pit of hate either way.
Well, he says, you know, hey, you know, either it's a life of slavery under Aku or a chance at escaping. And I think we should take that. They kind of go through the whole thing. And then Jack says he can do it. One of the scientists, the one that loves to point out probabilities with his calculator.
Yep.
Which calculators aren't by default. There's no reason they can particularly predict probabilities of certain actions, but.
Well, he's just, it's a little hand computer. it's a hand computer the way that the 60s and 70s would have thought about a hand computer. Like, their tech is almost magic that way because it does what they think it should do and it looks like they think it should look.
So
it doesn't have anything to do. Yeah. He's figuring out the odds.
So the statistician says, hey, he had a, you know, 1 in 300 chance of beating these things, and he actually did it. So maybe this guy, you know, he represents a boon to our chances of success that is greater than we originally were accounting for.
They even have a nerdy guy with a neck beard who goes, well, actually, and that's the funniest part for me, because that's like the internet now. The whole internet is full of guys like that.
Yeah, with the neck hair.
And he was the only one that was unshaven with a weird little hairs and a total nerd. I mean, he had the black glasses and little tape in the middle of the glasses because, you know, glasses used to crack or break there a lot because they're made of cheap Bakelite plastic.
As far as I'm concerned, this is who Mandark grew up into, by the way. Just saying. Green glasses.
Mandark was a touch more cool than that in his own evil way.
That's true.
Mandark had a bit more panache than that. He was, after all, attempting to get Dee Dee to like him. So, you know, Mandark had to learn some social skills. This guy looks like he spent most of the time in his own suit in virtual reality and, you know, playing lots of video games. But, yeah.
Anyways, so they determine their best bet for escaping is to train Jack. Since he can't fight them in space to break the blockade, they're going to give him a space suit. But before that, they have to give him some training. So we see the astronaut training montage. And I gotta say, it's pretty cool. And at this point, this is another type of training we've seen Jack go through since he started his journey. And this is one of the best ones.
He learns something. Every time that he meets a group, he learns something. He learns how to do something new. And as usual, Jack responds to the training like almost supernatural, almost preternaturally. Jack responds to training very well. Whatever it is that he's, no matter how unfamiliar it is, he learns how to do the thing once he figures out the thing and never forgets it.
Yeah, they give him the G-force training. They spin him around on that, centrifuge.
Centrifuge. It wasn't quite facing the right way. It was like facing forward instead of out toward the outside.
Yeah.
But he still got the squished face that face they get, you know, when they're like, it's peeling their face back from G-forces. Mm-hmm. Sorry, centripetal acceleration. And as they're whipping him around, you know, he's learning how to deal with G-forces. They put him in a bike underwater, so there's like upside down in a tank underwater.
So that they can see how he reacts to a lack of gravity as well.
And they have little sensors all over him. And, you know, Jack is in peak condition, and they're all smiling. Like, if you look at that thing, they're all like, wow, what a specimen. You know, as a human, he's amazing. Yep. And he is compared to all of them. They're all short people.
Just look at them. But yeah, at the end of the training, we see them start to suit him up and they put the suit on.
It's like an Iron Man thing. Like the bits are all assembled. It's awesome.
At the end of this, they bring in that rocket and the rocket is being held by this extremely over-manufactured device. that brings just the one rocket over, and everyone hides while they're placing this rocket on here, like there's something very dangerous about it. And they apply the rocket, it seals onto the suit, and then immediately one of the scientists comes up and starts smacking it, you know?
Well, they were calling back, I think, to two different things. One was Ghostbusters. Like, each one of us is wearing an unlicensed nuclear accelerator on his back. You know, these things have never survived a successful test in real life. Oh, well. Turn me on.
Yeah.
And everyone moves away. Like, and then Back to the Future where, you know, Doc Brown has got the suit on and he's really careful with the plutonium. And then he shuts it and like, boom, kicks the thing shut, takes it. It's okay. Everything's lead-lined. You were just so gentle with this thing. I think it's because they were repurposing whatever that big thing was to move this tiny thing, because for whatever reason it had more precise controls and it could withstand being blown up. So once they attach it to him, ding, on the back, this enormous, you know, it's, again, it's a kid's cartoon. So they throw in this dichotomy of enormous thing run by apparently two little pilots, which are supposed to look like eyes, you know, but it's actually two pilots through a windshield. And they use this tiny little claw to attach this tiny little
rocket, you
know, beer keg sized rocket thing to his back. And suddenly he's Super Jack. Well, we have to begin your training here and show you how this works. And Jack's like, gives zero fucks.
He accidentally he closes his hand, which has the controls on it.
Yeah, in the palm. That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's a little.
You press different buttons on your palm with your fingers, and as soon as the two like wires touch each other, it activates this thing that changes your trajectory. And Jack apparently closed his hands like he was ready for the training and just launches into the sky. And we see him try to figure it out. And over the course of it, we see him, he chops down this section of trees, and the scientists recognize we're not watching somebody use this for space exploration right now.
Mm-hmm.
That you see them all say, wow, you know, and what's happening? Basically, this is the first time they've seen their technology for being astronauts, just for space exploration, being used by a trained martial artist for combat.
Who understands kinesthetics.
Yeah.
Who understands how what power and thrust and movement mean and how those forces act on his body. Jack is a genius in that, as we may have mentioned. He understands movement. And when he first figures out, he's like a balloon with the air releasing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He flies all over going, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. And he's everywhere. And finally, he starts figuring it out. And, oh, if I put this finger, I go this way. If I put this finger, I reverse. If I do this finger, I do a barrel roll.
Yeah.
And he's like, whoa, oh, I see. Cool. If I hit all of them, then I thrust up. And we see him in the course of these few seconds overcome his fear of rocketry. Because he was scared shit. The first time he went up, scared shitless. The look on his face is like, ah. Totally out of control, but his discipline, his beautiful lifelong training in mental discipline.
Yep.
He freaked out for a few, just like he did with the kids when they told him what era he was in. He freaked out for a few seconds and then got his shit together and went, oh, I need to work the problem. This is how this works. This is how this works. Okay. And by the end of it, he does the Superman thing where he just flies up and there's this glorious sun in the sky. And he's like, this can be beautiful. Technology can be beautiful.
Yep.
And he incorporates the suit as part of him. He's not operating a piece of machinery. He's wielding the suit like he wields the sword.
Yep.
By the end of this. And when he finally understands what it does, then he starts flying down and starts going, ha! And he mows down some trees. And he does this cool sword stab pivot thing, which is awesome.
The tree thing happens before he shoots up and goes
oh, yeah. That's when he figures out thrust and right, he's flying forward. He's doing that to get them out of his way.
Yep.
So he won't run into them.
Right. And but what they see, the scientists then see, like, with this, he really can break the blockade.
Because like, we're very familiar with how the blockade works, which makes me wonder what they had meant to do without Jack to get past it.
Yeah.
I think they just meant to outrun it.
Yeah, because you could see they tried to tell him, like, look, we're just going to teleport out of here, you know, like.
We're going to make a break for it, and we're going to max out our engines to do it.
If they had, though, it's a question of whether those insect drones would have come with them, you know, because they had them digging in, you know what I mean?
That's true. It would have been a it would have been a successful failure, because they would have gotten away and hit light speed, but those bugs could have told Aku exactly where they went.
Or worse, continued drilling.
Yeah, and just – but, I mean, they do have environment suits. It would have been a problem of them destroying the engines.
Yeah.
and, you know, actually hurting the vessel.
Or draining the energy
out. Because we saw four different kinds of bugs in this episode.
Get to that. Because on the night before their launch, we see this party.
They have a cocktail party, Matt.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful early 1960s Playboy cocktail party where they're all sitting around and talking and discussing scientific things, and they're flirting. And there's about 5% women there, which... we also see that a lot of these people are also clones. They are drawn very similarly. And this isn't, this serves the purpose of putting them in the background, but we see in later episodes that the storyboard artists love doodling up weird characters. There's no lack of imagination for them putting completely unique characters filling the background.
Yeah, and that's really when we look at this one and the Critcholites, the choice to make them all look the same or copies of each other can't be just for the ease of drawing it, because look, they like to do a variety of things and show interesting visuals. So maybe they are a bunch of clones, because they all look very similar and are all approximately the same age as their clones. So,
although I think the young girl, the young lady, and the young nerd, the one who says, come on, guys, we can recruits. Do it. They said, this happened before you were born.
Yeah.
Now, it's unclear whether they were born of the scientists or just born and recruited.
Right.
So that could be either way. You're right. I think that the scientists themselves found a way to increase their effectiveness under Aku by cloning themselves.
Right.
And they found, because it's science, it's all 60s mad science they're doing.
And this is all headcanon, by the way.
Yeah. But, it's they put it on the screen. This is how the 1960s viewed rocket science. So a scientist is always right. That's a trope. Meaning, if you're a doctor or a scientist, then you can do all the sciences.
Right.
It's just like, for whatever reason, for story purposes, you can do all the sciences. And when it shows them all together at this party, you can see the different, the three or four different kinds. And there has to be at least 100 of them there. Just based on what's on screen, the curve of the room, the amount of chatter going on. There's like at least 100 of these scientists. And about 5% of them are women.
And we also saw that one, there's an interesting suit. A certain person has a space suit that accommodates two.
We'll put a screenshot up. It's great, guys. It's only on screen for maybe 3 seconds or less. But the expressions on people's face around them, it is quite clearly a two-person suit. And the woman and the man inside the suit are clearly naked. She's neck down and you can see part of her shoulders. She's not wearing anything. And the dude with her is talking to her. The dude directly behind's eye line is directly down through the dome where her boobs would be. And the dude behind him has this sly look on his face.
Yep.
It is a swinging 60s parties, guys. That's what this is. And they all, they all have this cool, Snoopy dance that they're all doing. And there's this cool, it's clearly, they needed the necessities at this place. They needed test facilities. They needed a centrifuge. They needed a party room. They needed to grow corn, which, they were probably there for a little while if they could actually grow crops for themselves. Supplies for the trip, probably. But they're still all dressed in their suits. Why are they in their suits in a ship? Well, this kind of goes back to something I thought of, the Quarians, when we talked about Mass Effect. The Quarians have a very low immune system. In this case of the scientists, they say,
oh, I am so excited! Soon we shall be at our new home!
We'll finally be able to use our science for good!
No more protection against the polluted air!
No more Aku robots!
Yeah, no more Aku!
And when they come out and they're talking about how we're going to get out of here and they're going to be here tomorrow morning and, we're partying now because this is basically our goodbye party to Earth. This is what we were planning the day before we launched anyway. So we might as well live it up.
Yeah.
We've already our work done. We have to wait for the orbital mechanics to line up before we can launch. Let's just have a party.
Yeah, and it seems to go pretty well. Although the group that Jack is chilling with, we see that they are concerned with their odds of escape. They're still sort of going over what's supposed to happen and what's...
And it's some ridiculous amount. It's 3 million to 1.
And we see that Jack retells his story here. He tells them why he is who he is and what he's doing. And they realize, time travel Well, here's a really interesting pseudoscience leap of faith we're making here. So they're like, all you have to do is jettison one of our escape pods while we're going sublight speed, which should launch you at faster than light speed, which we've seen this sort of trope in a number of sci-fi pieces.
Yeah, slingshot around the sun in Star Trek, for example, for Star Trek.
Yeah, like if you're going light speed and then you do something to travel faster than it, if you launch something that normally sends things faster than the object it's being launched from, you then are now going faster than light. Not sure about this theory.
Well, but when he tells them the story, though, he tells them, and I must find some magic to get back, and I don't, he's still conceptualizing his magic.
Right.
And he's very sad, and was that warrior you? Yeah. Well, when it cuts back to them, I wanted to mention this too, because it's a funny bit. They're all sitting around, and they're all manspreading.
Oh, yeah.
They're all sitting with their legs like this. And when it cuts to a different one showing the beautiful lady with the oval head, she has this wonderful oval suit. And then she has these gammon legs that are like folded one over the other, like in a pose on the side of a World War II bomber, like a 1940s model. And I'm like, you're all in suits. Manspreading is possible for all of you. Genitalia and underwear will not be revealed. That's why that pose was invented for women to sit sexy without showing off their panties, because they're wearing dresses traditionally. So when she's sitting like this, it's meant to look like she's got this sort of gammon supermodel look as she's sitting. She's very elegant and feminine in a 1950s style, because she wasn't sitting there with like one leg up. She wasn't sitting there with both legs crooked together or both hands on knees like it would be a demure look. She was sitting like a model with her knees pulled up and her toes pointed. It was just a cool little subtle detail that, unless you like really watch, this is why the storyboarders are so brilliant. They throw shit like this in. And it kind of shows their little culture too. Like, these humans are still trying to maintain. They're still, and they're all international. Did you notice that? Like, there's a German guy who's very afraid of everything. And, you know, then there's other guy who's figuring out the other thing on the, you know, this is all.
Oh, yeah. That guy was supposed to be Russian.
The Russian, but he didn't really roll his R. Like, it didn't sound right. It sounded more German to me. And then, of course, the woman is a Brit and she talks very British. And it's just cool. Like, they put together an international team of astronauts to go colonize another planet. It had all the gosh wow spaceman forward humanity stuff that was on all the sci-fi of the era. And Aku fucked with it. And Aku is trying to end it. So again, it's somebody else's story. Jack is the MacGuffin of someone else's story. Yep. Where they're going on a grand space adventure, and this is the second act of their space adventure. The enemies are closing in on them. They've already had an adventure planning this and getting away from Aku and setting up their space base in the middle of nowhere so they can get a good launch. And Aku still finds them. Damn it. And without Jack there.
More importantly, Jack led them to him.
Yeah, probably. If Aku can see where Jack is going, Aku probably found them that way.
Yeah.
Because he hadn't found them for months.
And he would have found them eventually.
Eventually, when they launched, but he would not have had his space armada ready for them.
Yep.
Their odds of escaping with Aku not knowing where they were launching from would have been far better. You know, 3-1, 2-1 against.
Yep.
Those are odds I can take. Like, death or getting away from Aku and you play Russian roulette for it. Okay. You know what? That's probably, if you're going to spend a life in servitude and your clone sisters and brothers in perpetuity will spend a life in servitude.
But yeah.
Let's risk it. You know,
in this conversation, we saw that Jack is a rocket man. sort of
burning out his fuse up here alone.
They say with him there, their odds of success are 3-1 against. Now, that's pretty good odds, is what the statistician says.
Is that warrior you?
Yes.
Wow. Time travel. What do you say, gentlemen?
You know a way to travel in time?
It's quite simple, really. Let's say this is the rocket. If you get into the escape pod at the nose of the ship and jettison when we hit sublight speed, that should put you faster than light.
Which will easily send you back to your own time.
And he's like, party, you know, have fun. We've got better odds than we ever expected, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, but he tells them why he can't party. They tell him about the jettison of the escape pod while at sublight.
Yep.
And everyone sort of nods and agrees, you know, oh, yes. And we hear in the background, someone's like, yes, yes, this theory is very sound.
This will work?
Oh, yes, this theory is very sound. It's going to work. Just make sure you're in the pod before we hit light speed. The rest will take care of itself.
I will.
You know, and just to clarify, in case any of the listeners were still wondering about this idea, that definitely, you know, the scientists are telling you it's totally sound and don't question it.
Okay, so that begs the next question. Why aren't the spacemen doing it?
Right.
If the spacemen could do it, why not attach an extra little booster rocket to a secondary stage to the rocket? Because it's a single stage rocket that gets them to orbit. Pretty good engineering there. And when they get there, why don't they have, a couple of booster rockets on the side? So they boost up to near light speed, and then right as they're ready to transition, boost again, and then they go back in time. They go back in time and take Jack with them. Why won't they do that? Because they could go back to a time when Aku was nothing. Well, they would have a huge amount of intelligence to give the rest of the galaxy about Aku. They could have warned everyone, but it doesn't occur to them to do that.
Well, actually, we've seen this sort of trope before where you jettison the thing at sublight and it goes faster than light. It gives it just enough. And what you just pointed out is the thing that everyone always seems to think is different in some way, where you put an extra jet on and you say, now that's going to push me faster than light. You know, why is it possible to go faster than light when you're jettisoning something with like a spring at faster than light, when if you just put a rocket on it, it should in theory do the same thing? Why can't you do that? Well, somehow the idea of just adding more thrust doesn't seem to have the same effect on the pseudoscience theory here that launching this pod off of an already traveling at light speed object.
Yeah.
It's something that you're not supposed to be thinking this much about,
I guess. And if they have already known how to, there must be some problem with it. Like, we can let him risk it, but for all of us to risk it would take more tech than we have. Maybe it's a matter of mass. Maybe it's a matter of what tech they had available or the energy they had available. Maybe going back in time and leaving the entire civilized galaxy as they know it, it was just too much to give up for them. Like, getting away from Aku still means we can hit other spacefaring races.
There's also the fact that, as far as they know, Aku's always ruled the world. So we have this situation where the beginning of history is the beginning of Aku. If we remember back before...
They wouldn't have fallen prey to that, though. They're scientists. They would know that the world is older than that.
In the dog episode, though, we understand that, much like our time is denoted based on Christian mythology, their time is noted based on Aku mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is Aku took over at this time. This is the beginning of time, you know, like,
yeah.
And you're right that they're probably aware that there was a time before, but knowing for sure how far back they need to go in order to stop Aku is a big question mark. Matter of fact, if they had gone back to just before Aku started taking over, they would just go back to Tar Pit Aku. They wouldn't be able to find him. They wouldn't be able to destroy him.
Tar Pit Aku would have been contained. Tar Pit Aku would never have arisen. It would have taken him a lot longer to arise as a sentient thing. And he might have simply been encapsulated. Or they might have...
They wouldn't have known he was ever a Tar Pit. You know?
Yeah, that's true. If they had managed to go back and establish a technological civilization on Earth back during what was clearly the muddled Middle Ages of Earth's prior history, it's possible that they could have just built and built and built and then run into Aku. And then Aku would have come to life. Maybe they would have given him some sort of technological means to arise, but they wouldn't have known what to make of him.
Well,
he was a black tar pit.
If they did the thing, they went back to just before Aku took over and establish their colony, they would have colonized for a little bit. And then sometime during that time, the emperor comes, he shoots the tar pit, and Aku's born anyways. So, like, they wouldn't have known when or where he started, you know?
That's true. And Jack didn't tell them.
Yeah.
It just never occurred to him to tell them because that wasn't his story.
If we're discussing why they never used time travel, that's probably it. There's no telling when or where or how you have to go back to stop a coup anyways.
Yeah.
It's just it's a fool's errand. You might as well just escape and get out of here.
Getting away from here is probably a better deal as far as they're concerned because they can just keep running. As long as there's out of Aku's immediate sphere of influence, Aku doesn't leave the planet as far as we see.
And all of his ships are insect-based.
Yeah. So. When they come back from commercial after having the big party and, you know, stating their purpose, we're going to space. And Jack now has space training and a space suit with a cool jetpack because everybody loves jetpacks. That's like the biggest iconography of the future right there is that jetpack. Yep. And they don't all have jetpacks. That's not a technology they feel safe using. And they're not combat trained. They don't have the kinesthetics that Jack does, but they just watched him jump around and slice these giant robots in half. 100-foot-tall robots that he just... And they don't even know what his sword is. I mean, one of the things they would have been cool to throw in if this had been a longer episode is, well, that's an interesting sword you've got there. How does that work? You know, and showing them trying to do tests on the sword and whatnot would have been kind of neat. And it might have been a way to drop a little bit more knowledge about what the sword actually was. Hmm. But getting in, when they come back from this, Aku's minions are closing in. Boop, boop, boop. We see them come in on the radar and they're closing in. Yep. The scientists are like, fuck you.
Yep.
And blast off to orbit. And Jack is apprehensive, but he's not scared. He's not clutching like, oh God, oh God, oh God, I'm going to die. Like
I mean, we do see him clutch the seat a little bit, but he's crazy.
Dealing. He has training now. He's dealing with it. Like, okay, this is acceleration. I know what this feels like. It's unpleasant, but I get it. And the scientists are all, you know, one of them's sleeping. Somebody wake up, Hicks, you know, like an aliens.
It's interesting, though. Within the ship, the seats all appear to be shared. Some of them actually look like comfy living room couches. Some of them look like they'd be comfy now, you know? Mm-hmm.
Even without wearing a big pod suit.
Yeah, it was just interesting to see, like, it is the spaceship. It is obviously based on a real-world space shuttle or rocket. But there's certain things that they've made different just because, you know.
Yeah, and it's, to my eyes, it's sort of a cross between a Saturn V and a Russian Energia, which was their old heavy lift vehicle. Which had those sort of sloping rocket pods on the sides. And the Saturn V was better engineered and had more powerful rockets so they didn't need as many. So it could all fit within the same frame.
Mm-hmm.
And they only stuck out a little bit at the bottom, which made it more aerodynamic. And they wanted to evoke this sense of, it looks like an amalgam of all the spacecraft you've ever seen.
Right.
In the 60s. So it looked like an Energia. It looked like a Saturn V. It looked maybe a little bit of Titan thrown in there. And the nose cone was a pine tree. Which I thought was really cute. But I mean, they were trying to disguise it.
Camouflage, yep.
Yeah, they were, to anybody looking across the treetops, they wouldn't see a rocket nose cone, they'd see a tree. And I thought that was kind of a nice little touch where they were doing their best to try to camouflage it and make it not look like they were there. And those are pretty tall trees. Like that's probably the reason they chose that spot.
Yep.
Because those really tall forests could hide their really tall rocket. And again, they're nerds. They're smart. Of course, they would have had a plan to get out.
Yeah, they went to like the one redwood forest.
Anywhere. Yeah. Or at least it's the one that we've seen for now on the planet. So they finally blast off into space and it's a great launch sequence. And it cuts to the little mug that says, I heart space.
Oh, I heart science.
I heart science. That was it. And that was awesome. Like nerds be nerds. Of course they have novelty mugs.
Yep.
That was great.
Matter of fact, I bet you that mug exists in their office somewhere. Like one of their animators or somebody in their studio has
an I Heart Science mug.
I would be pretty sure.
Well, when they get there, they indicate, oh, we're in zero G now. And it kind of floats up and Jack is like experiencing something new again. Zero G. He's watching the coffee float away. And I don't think that would be a problem for their suits, but it would be a problem for the ship electronics. It just seems like somebody forgot their cup of coffee. Again, how are they drinking? Their suits are sealed. How are they drinking at the party with the bartender pouring drinks? Their suits are sealed. But then again, their suits are sealed. So two of them can fit into one of them. And you can have a hot babe sitting on your knee in your suit, just like they did at the party.
The weirdest thing.
Who knows? so they go into space and there's like, okay, we have to prep Jack. And they get him all in his suit. And then we need to get him to the airlock. Oh, we're approaching Aku's blockade. Aha! Aku's blockade. That's why no one leaves. And we see that it's not a series of giant space battleships. It's not a mothership launching fighters. It's not space-based laser satellites like we humans would build. No, it's a fucking swarm of robot bugs in space, because that's Aku.
It's true. Now, these scientists designed these as well, almost certainly, because they share so many similarities to the other insect-based drones that they've made for Aku. It's very likely that the thing that they're fighting right now that's keeping them locked on the planet is actually something they've designed themselves.
Or progenitors of theirs did. You have this idea that they've been around for quite a while. At least as long as Hub City or the central hub has been built up.
Yeah.
That once you have a spaceport, you need space defenses. And that has to extend pretty far into space. Especially low Earth orbit, and especially around just where ships would launch from that general part of the planet. So it makes sense that if Aku was alerted, he was already moving these space-based bugs to try to intercept where they were going to launch from. Again, that's kind of Aku's cunning. He looks ahead, he sees what they're going to do, he devises tactics based on what he knows, and they're usually pretty solid and straightforward. Send in the bugs. Yep. And I'll be damned if these things didn't look like fucking Galaga. These things were coming in waves, in these awesome patterned waves of giant flying space bugs, and wasps. They looked like a video game.
Bees. We had
ticks, wasps.
Ticks, wasps, and mosquitoes.
And mosquitoes. And each time we are watching Jack win a space combat scenario with a sword again.
And we saw that great thing when he realized they were ticks, and he remembered how he used to deal with ticks when he was in the woods. He would take a burning ember from the fire and stick it on the ass of the tick so that it would itself choose to remove its head from his skin so that he wouldn't leave the head stuck in his body by pulling it out.
Which would regrow.
Which is what he had happening. He was killing these things and their heads were still drilling into the ship. So he then sets his sword on fire with rocket
with
fuel.
Rocket fuel.
And then proceeds to annihilate all the tick heads.
And it's brilliant because he knows the sword can take it. The sword has been through much with him. It's magic. It's not going to be affected by normal physical forces. So, hey, it's on fire now. Okay.
Any regular folded steel sword is gone after that little treatment.
of blasting heat and then frozen cold of space would shatter.
Jet fuel can burn, melt steel swords is all I'm saying.
The kind of steel that would have been made in medieval times, no problem. It would have definitely made it glow red and softened it. The sword would have been ruined. But it's a magic celestial sword forged with god power and his dad's soul.
Yeah.
Fire ain't going to touch it. But he's also they stole this sequence pretty much straight out for episode 3 of Star Wars when they had the whole big battle scene at the beginning. And Anakin and Kenobi are flying around in their space battle Jedi fighters. And they released these
saw droids
which would fly backwards and somehow manage in the hugeness of space to find a single fighter and latch onto it and then start literally ripping the ship open from the surface of the ship, which is something you can really only do with slow flying fighters like that. And, you know, they had to use force powers and R2 and various and sundry flying tricks to knock them off. But they were still literally ripping the ship up because they were inside the ship's shields. Yep. And the ship didn't really even have shields. They had to keep it as light as possible to get as many people off as they could. I'm sure they could have devised shields for it, but they were trying to get as many scientists off as they could.
Yep.
And when they finally, you know, they're, oh God, what are we going to do? They're attacking us. They're drilling in through the vessel. They weren't worried about losing cabin pressure. They were worried about the bugs getting in to destroy the engines. And if effectively Jack jumps up and starts slicing them off, burning them off, cutting them in half, flying around in space and just zipping through groups of them and exploding them. And it's a great, awesome kinetic space battle with a jetpack.
We see the wasps. They shoot these little scatter bombs and he destroys those.
Stinger missiles.
And the mosquitoes did something really cool. The mosquitoes were only there to drain fuel out of the fuel tanks. I thought that was a cool idea.
Again, that kind of leads to Aku wants to recapture them. he was not, they did not immediately form into the big gun like they did at the end.
Right.
To shoot them immediately, which if he wanted them destroyed, he would have.
Yeah, just blow them.
They were probably programmed with disable, destroy, stop them. I need to recapture them now that they're in space. I can bring them back anytime I want. They were not trying to destroy the vessel as much as disable it.
Those are his scientists.
Mm-hmm. And when they devised these things, they were supposed to be capable of dealing with any different sort of alien spacecraft. And you also get the impression they let things in, but not out. They were definitely designed to not harass things coming in, because we see at least two or three other spacefaring species crash, and Aku deals with them. But these things were meant to keep them from leaving. And disabling a ship with a bunch of tiny little things that you can't shield against without a convenient jetpack samurai? Yeah. I like the way, too, that Jack has really gained competency. Like, once he's let off his leash and he can just fly around and do his thing, he's Superman.
Yeah.
He's just amazing at it.
And it's worth noting that a lot of the strategies and the tactics, the combat that he's engaged in here, and you pointed it out first that I realized, like, oh, you're right. Every battle he's been in, he's gone out of his way to employ sort of the principles of Aikido.
What's Aikido, Matt?
Essentially, it's a martial art that's focused around taking the force and the movement of an opponent when they're aggressive and turning it against them, basically using those forces to knock them down or to sweep them off balance or to take advantage of the moment where they are already off balance.
Yep.
And what does he do? He spends his whole time taking their attacks and turning them back on themselves.
Getting the missiles to follow him. He's drawing aggro like a good tank. Once he sliced them all off the ship and burned off, it killed the mosquito. Now it's like, okay, the AI readjusts and says, oh, they can defend against this. Here's the real threat, just like the mantises did.
Yep.
It's the same level of AI. Once might be luck, twice is for real. Mm-hmm. Now we need to adjust our tactics to attack the threat that's attacking us, not our objective.
Kill the thing with missiles. So they send off all these missiles, and again, like I said, he just redirects the attack into them again.
Whoosh, boom. Yeah, they shoot each other, which that's how he takes out one of the mantises, is getting it to follow him and then raking its fire across the other, blows up, which is smart. Jack is using the tactics he's learned as a samurai, and he's applying them to a battlefield. He didn't really get a chance to turn the beetle bugs against themselves. There wasn't really an opportunity for him to do that.
There were times where he had them slash and cut each other or indirectly block each other's attacks.
Oh, yeah, because he would, like duck under and the blades would all block each other. That was clever. So that was probably some instance of that earlier. But this is a much greater expansion. It's
very clear, that's what he's going for in these battles. Just use as little energy as you have to. Make them kill each other.
I'd also like to point out that the space bugs, as they are attacking him like this, are they're what Aku knows. Like, Aku doesn't conceptualize things like motherships with fighters. He doesn't conceptualize a space-based laser platform and put a whole lot into, you know, cutting through ECMs and directed laser beams. He's not about efficiency. He's about terror. And seeing a swarm of bugs come towards your ship is terrifying. That's not something most spacefarers see.
Right.
But you have to imagine how did Aku start? As a tar pit, like we mentioned.
Right.
A good percentage of the megatonnage of life that he ate over a million years, however long, was probably bugs.
Yep.
Bugs that landed on the evil spiritual antenna that were sticking up, bugs that fell out of the sky, bugs that were in the stomachs of birds that fell into the pit that he also ate.
Yep.
Like, he understood bugs. Bugs were around for a very long time before higher orders of life.
He was just sitting there watching and
absorbing.
For all this time before there was ever any kind of technology, there were no tanks, no jet fighters, nothing like that. For the longest time, his main inspiration for most of his existence would have to come from this period where everything was quite grounded.
Mm-hmm.
And what scares all the mammals, what scares all the big animals? Insects. Things with stingers and venom and poison and creepy crawlies. So we see him employing animal-based technology all the time.
Ticks, mosquitoes, and they flap their wings in space for some reason.
No
reason to do that, guys, but they do. Probably he told them to do that. Like, well, here's our space bug, and it's like,
Can you make their wings flap?
I suppose we could do that.
Ha, 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 good.
Like, you can see him like, oh, that's just the special sauce. Make their wings flap. That's scary. Well, you
know, I mean, there are people who have a specific fear, a phobia of the four-winged flapping of dragonfly wings. So maybe it's just there for the creepiness effect.
True. And at this point, though, they've broken through most of the lines. And the bugs are finally using their full power. Not just a percentage of their full power. And they decide that they're going to make a gigantic bug beam by merging together and creating a giant wave motion laser to zap the ship with. And Jack has secured himself. He's already made it back to the ship. You know, they're strapping him in. They're getting ready to hit light speed. And this bug is forming into what Matt pointed out looks like a thing in badminton that they knock back and forth.
Yep.
Which I identified as a shuttlecock. And I just like
there
saying,
you go.
It's like saying cock. So they're forming together, and it's this great montage where they're cutting between, you know?
Yep.
And Jack is like, wait a minute, what are they doing? They're making a giant beam, and the guy gets on his little computer. Beep, 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 beep. Well, actually, their odds are...
Jack's unlocking!
What?
Jack, what are you doing? We're almost at top speed!
The robots must not fire that gun.
The odds of them hitting us at this speed are 325 to 1!
I cannot take that chance.
But you'll never make it back in time! Jack!
We have a 300 odd, because of you, we have a 300 to 1 odds of escaping. Better odds than the million to 1 against that we had before. You helped us. You are the specific reason we made it this far. And you get to enjoy the fruits of that. 300 to 1 odds, I'll take that. And
you know, you have to look at it from his point of view. You know, we're talking about a guy that did medieval combat here. So he sees the enemy pointing a one-hit kill at the project that he's helping to save. And everyone who's already shown they were cowards for most of this anyways is saying like, no, stay in here, stay in here. And he's like,
they were cautious. They're scientists, man. That's what they do.
No. I'm going to go stop the evil thing.
But he didn't have to. I believe it was a bad decision.
No, yeah.
Because all he had to do was make it to the future. All he had to do was sit tight, believe the scientists, and make it to the future. And if he had done that, he would have crashed in the same primitive circumstances, but it would have been his own
but
time.
But what would you say if I told you in Bushido, the idea of being killed while running away is unforgivable, you know? Like,
then I would say that would give a lot more depth to Jack's decision.
Yeah, I mean.
Because by our Western standards, you know, you got this. You know, your scientists are telling you, you have a 301 chance to win. You have you earned it. You were out there flying around and you killed the bugs off and you were instrumental in getting us out of the situation. So enjoy it. You won. Come with us.
But from his point of view, it's like, if we're that one, if it's that one this time, then I will die with extreme dishonor. We were running with our tails between our legs when we got killed. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
That's unconscionable to do that.
That's not the way a warrior dies.
And he doesn't – again, he thinks like a warrior, not a soldier. He thinks like a samurai, not a scientist. It's the man, not the sword. Jack has got to get out of his own head. He's got to understand that there are better and different ways of accomplishing your goals, and that honor, that system of combat that he has, that system of I wish to end the fight, not punish my foe. And in this case, I wish to end the fight completely. I must have 100% victory in this fight, or I haven't won. A strategic retreat is not something that Jack is comfortable with, or probably even was taught. You know, he doesn't understand that an overall war is a give and take of battles, and that sometimes strategically this battle can't be won, and you have to cut your losses and go.
Well, yeah, you know,
or sometimes it's worth it to just go for it and take the risk. But again, he has pledged his service and his protection and his sword to the protection of these innocents as he sees them. These people who are, in his eyes, maybe not cowards, but definitely mainly defenseless. They're like that deer.
Yep.
You know, they're peaceful. They don't want to use their science for bad. They explicitly say, now we'll have a chance to use our science for good.
Right.
And
they don't want to keep making weapons. Yeah.
They hate that. So for him, though, he is a weapon.
Yep.
I am the thing that's supposed to defend you. You can't go out and do the good in the galaxy that you do unless I throw myself into the teeth of adversity yet again. Yep. Even though that's not the best choice to make in this situation. He can't adjudicate that in his head. His honor, his training, everything about who he is says, I have to make the stupid decision and stay here and kill the thing. And yep. It turns out whether it would have hit or not, it doesn't really indicate. That's the other funny thing. The cartoon doesn't actually say whether that beam would have hit the ship. It didn't like line up along it to show that it was pointed right at it and that Jack actually did. It's left obscure. It's left like, did Jack actually save them or was that a mistake?
Right.
And from my interpretation, from my Western point of view, it was. For Jack, that's the only choice he could have made.
Yep.
Is going in and following his gut. And I will not let Aku win by proxy now, even by a tiny bit.
Exactly.
In that case, he has kind of learned his lesson though, hasn't he?
He's learned a small lesson.
He's not hesitating and he's not giving Aku an inch.
Think about everything that's gone into making sure he succeeds.
Yeah.
If he fails now, and especially fails while running away, yikes. Like that's... his entire country is going to look down on him in the afterlife.
And the sword would still remain in this time. The sword is indestructible. The ship would blow up. The sword would just float around in space.
Yeah, sword.
It would deorbit eventually because it's in an unstable orbit and it would just fall into Earth's orbit.
We see that the sword... In season 5, we'll find out more about the sword itself. And
oh, cool. Okay.
And I think that it wouldn't have floated around in space. Honestly, chances are it would have ceased to exist. But we'll see more about that later.
He's bound to it somehow. Yeah. We've kind of flat that into, like, it has to be someone of the Emperor's blood wielding it because part of his soul is in it. That would seem to make supernatural sense in that case. And if they followed through on it, that's awesome. I still have to watch season 5.
Yeah. Well, we'll get there.
We'll get there. But the episode closes with Jack pretty much, you know, Supermaning it and flying. I had another screenshot where he's like flying with one arm forward and one leg pulled up. Like I'm flying forward to punch it in space.
Yeah. But what I wanted to point out, you know, we see him, he guards against the laser beam. The laser beam hits the sword. And what does he do? Again, it's sort of this principle of taking the attack and sending it back because that's exactly what happens. He channels the attack back out through the sword and it blows the giant wasp gun to smithereens.
Jack turned the attack back, Matt.
And then he fell back to the earth.
He came back.
Yep.
So I want to think that since he had a supersuit, it was specifically engineered to be his supersuit because it didn't look like it would fit any of the rest of them.
That's true.
This was a one-off nerd extreme. We happen to have the lab to do this with, and we can build you a suit from parts that we have and then supercharge it. So it would seem to me as if – and the suit didn't take any damage from anything.
That's true.
He didn't do the usual, you know – I get a little cut and then my kimono my gi gets cut and then I lose the gi and now I'm down to my underwear and I'm covered in black ichor. Like it didn't do the usual Jack's losing hit points sequence. There was one where the mosquito was trying to stab through the faceplate that he grabbed the mosquito's,
proboscis.
Proboscis. Thank you. That's a good word. And, you know, cause he didn't know that it wouldn't stab through it. It probably wouldn't have, but I think that they supercharged his suit. The reason they were so delicate with that rocket engine is because it had an enormous amount of power in it. And maybe they used the last of their fuel or something to put in it. Hmm. And when they did that, it was like, okay, we're putting everything we can. They're maxing out what they can give to this one guy, which means that the suit was not damaged when that thing hit him, it hit the sword. And it was showing him going bff, bff, and being zapped by it. But he wouldn't have even survived that holding the sword. The sword was absorbing most of it and then turning it back. Supernaturally, it was bending the laws of physics to bend the beam back against it. He just happened to be too close to where that – he was getting a flashback from whatever energy was coming off the beam. That wasn't even the beam. It was hitting the sword.
Yep.
And so it still had enough energy left to protect him while he reentered. And when he hit the ground, boom, like a meteorite, it still protected him to where when he got up, the suit was utterly destroyed. It had, you know, like Iron yep. Man's suit. You know, again, they kind of probably looked at this episode a little bit when they were thinking about how Iron Man works in the That's modern true. Marvel movies. You know, the suit gets horribly damaged every time. You're up against forces that are, that will win. Your suit is only, even as super as that suit looks, it is just barely up to galactic standards. Just barely.
Yep.
Anything in Guardians of the Galaxy could kick Iron Man's ass in Mark I armor. It, from what we saw in Guardians of the Galaxy, for what galactic technology is, Iron Man was just at the very bottom rung, and that was the cutting edge of humans on Earth. And in the same way, this super suit was the cutting edge of what these things had. It was just enough to save Jack from dying during the entry. But that's all it needed. It was just enough to keep him from getting squished. And then he woke up, dropped the helmet off, walks off into the distance. It's a really great shot, too. It's got like the helmet, the smoking helmet in the foreground as he walks away.
Yeah, I found this episode really good. And at the end, we see him continue on in what I can only assume is north because he still hasn't found the thing that he was foretold that would take him.
Well, that was the thing. That was one of the things the Wooly was talking about. The Wooly might have even astrally traveled to find out where the scientists were.
Well,
to understand what they were capable of.
We see in
that dude knew a lot more than he let on. He was a magic space hippie. In
the next episode at the beginning, we see that he's still following the directions of the Woolies, so.
Okay. Well, we'll get there in the next episode. But, I don't think I have anything more I wanted to follow up on my own self. I think we kind of integrated.
Yeah. Yeah. We got it. We said everything we wanted to.
Love the art style. I love the retro 60s look. It is so different from the dystopian 80s of Hub City.
Yep.
It is so different from the, post-apocalyptic Canyon bug attack.
Yeah.
It's so different from the supernatural cave fight he had with Aku. Like they're already exploring so many different styles and it's only been 6 or 7 episodes. And well, no, in this case, in the actual continuity, what, 4? And they've already gone through and explored these wonderful art styles. And I won't say they actually did that 50s style. They spoke Samurai Jack's animation style with that accent.
Yep.
Like they were mimicking that style through how they normally draw people in Samurai Jack. So I loved that part of it just from an art standpoint. Yep. They were very dense and very concise. They gave, as usual, a whole bunch of clues in the background. If you just, again, those Blu-ray moments, man, just if you watch this episode on a computer, make sure you're pausing it for some of these scenes we talked about and you'll see what we're talking about. And it's hilarious. And they knew they could get away with it in a kid's cartoon because it was only on screen for like 1 second. But they knew if they threw it in, that was just for them. That was just for the animators to do. But I think we're at the end of the episode here, and I greatly enjoyed this one. We're looking forward to the next one, which is...
I think it's Jack and Ikra. A very interesting and popular episode.
Jack and the Warrior Woman, I think it is.
Ah, okay.
Which is a very different, again, a different take on Jack. We get to see another village, but it's not really technological. It looks sort of Middle Eastern. It looks like it could be anywhere between, you know, 1000 BC and now.
I actually think we will see the same exact location again in season 5.
Another
I think
callback,
they
then,
end up, yeah, calling back to this exact town. So cool. This will be interesting. It'll be a fun one.
Mm-hmm. Jack is another lead on how to get forward in time. And he meets up with an unexpected companion along the way, which is all we're going to say as a teaser.
So he's following the Wooly's direction. We'll see he meets somebody that can help him. And that somebody leads him to someone else. It's very interesting. So we'll get to that.
We'll get there. But until then, thank you very much for joining us for this episode of Backjack, the Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast. I'm Andy.
And I'm Matt.
And we'll see you later, guys.
And I think it's gonna be a